Mahabharata, Chapter 50, Sikandi's Destiny, as told by Bhishma. As you know, I long ago accepted a vow neither to occupy the throne nor to have children who could lay claim to it. My father, Shantanu, then married the beautiful Satyavati and had two sons, Chitrangada and Vichitravirya. He died before his sons were grown, and I was left as their protector. Chitrangada was killed in a battle with the Gandharva king, and Vichitravirya was left sole heir to the throne. As he came of age, I thought it time to find him a wife. I heard that the king of Kashi had arranged a swayamvara for his three daughters, Amba, Ambika, and Ambalika. I decided to ride into Kashi on my chariot, prepared for battle. Kings and princes had assembled at the Swayamvara from all over the world, all hoping one of the girls would choose to marry them. Upon seeing this, I remembered that the wise approve of many kinds of marriage, but for a Kshatriya, the best is when the bride is snatched from an assembly of warriors after defeating them in a fight. I then announced to the kings that I had decided to carry away all three princesses for my younger brother, and I challenged them to prevent me if they could. I took all three maidens onto my chariot and sped away. The kings were at first surprised, then furious. They pulled on their armor and mounted their chariots. Soon hundreds of them were in pursuit. Thousands of arrows showered down upon my chariot, but I dexterously avoided them all. As the princesses trembled in fear, I took up my own bow and turned to face the kings. I countered the shower of their arrows with my own. At the same time, I pierced every one of my antagonists. So swiftly did I shoot my arrows that my foes were completely confounded and could only applaud my prowess. Some were killed, and others had their weapons smashed and their armor torn off. They retreated and fled in various directions. Shalva, however, continued to chase me. He was determined to win the hand of one of the maidens, and he rushed after me, saying, "Stay, stay!" Provoked, I faced him. A furious but short-lived battle ensued. I soon overpowered Shalva and destroyed his chariot, although I decided not to kill him. I then returned to Hastinapur with the three maidens. When I arrived in Hastinapur, the eldest princess, Amba, approached me and said, "I had already chosen Shalva as my husband. He too accepted me in his heart, and my father agreed to the match. I would have chosen him in the Swayamvara, but you kidnapped me, and I did not have the opportunity. O knower of virtue, tell me, what should I do now?" I asked her to wait while I discussed the matter with the Brahmins. It was concluded that Amba should be allowed to go to Shalva's city and offer herself to him. We gave her an escort of priests and maidservants, and sent her to Shalva. When he saw her, however, he said, "O lady of fair complexion, I no longer desire to accept you as my wife, for you have already been taken by another. You were led away cheerfully by Bhishma before all the other kings. How can I, who must lay down the law for others, now accept you? You have been touched by another. According to the holy books, I cannot now accept you as my wife." Amba tried to change Shalva's mind, pleading that she had not been happy to be kidnapped. She had gone to Shalva at the first opportunity. The king was adamant. He would not accept her. He told the disappointed princess to return to Hastinapur. Weeping like a she-osprey, she thought, "What woman in the world could fall into greater trouble than the predicament I now face? I have been robbed of my friends. Shalva has wronged me. Neither can I now return to Hastinapur, and neither can I go home in such shame and rejected by everyone." Reflecting on the cause of her troubles, Amba decided that I was to blame. She wanted revenge. Rather than return to Hastinapur, she chose to go to a hermitage and stayed the night. In the morning, the rishi saw her weeping and inquired about her sorrow. The lady told them everything and asked them to help her. But the rishis replied, "We have renounced all worldly action. What can we possibly do to help your cause? Amba asked that they allow her to remain with them and to engage in asceticism. She had decided that the calamity that had befallen her was the result of her past sins, and that by practicing penance she could become freed of them. The rishis consulted among themselves. Some thought Shalva should have accepted her, while others proposed that I should marry her. Eventually, they decided that she should return to her father, for a woman must always be under the shelter of a husband, son, or father. But Amba refused to go. She said she would never return to her father's city and suffer disgrace. While the rishis thus sat, pondering about what to do, the royal sage, Hotravahana, arrived at the hermitage. He took special pity on Amba, because he happened to be her maternal grandfather. He became enraged that I had stolen her and thus ruined her life. With his lips trembling in anger, he said, "O Amba, you have grieved enough. Do not go to your father's house, for that will only increase your grief. You should place your case before the great Parasaram. He is my good friend and well-wisher. For my sake, he will surely remove your grief. Either he will convince Bhishma to accept you, or he will slay him in battle. Only this sage is powerful enough to do either." It so happened that Parasaram was due to arrive at the hermitage the next day. He arrived early in the morning, clad in black deer skins and surrounded by his disciples. With an axe over his shoulder and a bow in his hand, he was a frightening sight. Long matted locks hung down to his shoulders, and his eyes blazed like fire. After he had been properly received and worshipped by the other sages, he sat down with Hotravahana and was told of Amba's plight. He called for her and said, "You are as dear to me as you are to Hotravahana. Tell me what I should do for you. If you like, I can order Bhishma to accept you. If he will not, then I will consume him and all his ministers in battle. Or, if you prefer, I will order Shalva. Tell me your decision, O princess." Amba replied, "It seems that Bhishma is the cause of my present calamity. I think you should slay him. I have become so vengeful that I now wish only to bring about his death. O great sage, kill that covetous and mean-spirited man for my sake." Parasaram was reluctant to take up arms against me and said, "I will only use my weapons if the Brahmins request it. This is my vow. I can, however, make either Bhishma or Shalva accept my order. Therefore, select one of them as your husband, fair maiden, and I will do the rest." Amba had already concluded that all she wanted was for me to die. She asked Parasaram again and again to challenge me to a fight. At that time, another rishi, Akritavana, feeling compassion for Amba, also requested him to fight. Because a Brahmin requested him, Parasaram finally said, "All right, I will go to Bhishma to seek a solution by peaceful means. If he will not accept my words, then I will certainly slay him." The following day, he made his way to Hastinapur with Amba. I worshipped him with all respect, and then he said with anger in his voice, "O Bhishma, in what consciousness did you kidnap Amba? Although you took her by force, you then sent her away. You have robbed her of virtue, for no other man will now accept her. Therefore you should accept her, either for your brother or for yourself." I replied, "I cannot by any means take back this maiden, for she has given her heart to another. It is always wrong for a virtuous man to accept such a woman. I cannot renounce my duty out of fear, greed, attachment, or pity. This is my vow, O Rama." The sage blazed, "If you do not act according to my instructions, then I shall slay you and all your ministers." He said this repeatedly, and I tried in many ways to calm him with gentle words. Realizing that he was bent upon fighting, I asked, "Why do you wish to fight with me, O best of your race? In my childhood I was your pupil, and you taught me the military arts." Parasaram replied, "Although I am your preceptor, you have not obeyed my command. There is only one way to gratify me. Either accept this maiden and perpetuate your race, or prepare yourself for death." But my guru's words found no place in my heart. I replied, "O Lord, what you are commanding me to do, I cannot do. What is the use of laboring for it? What foolish man would accept into his house a woman sighing for another? Furthermore, I have made a solemn vow never to marry. I see no virtue in your order. The god Vayu has stated that a preceptor may be abandoned if he is vain, has swerved from the right path, or does not know his proper duties. I see no sin in fighting with you on this occasion rather than accepting your order. You are asking me to engage in an unrighteous act only for your profit. Witness now the strength of my arms and my superhuman prowess. Let us go to Kurukshetra. Slain by my arrows, you will attain the glorious regions you have earned by asceticism, O you whose only wealth is devotion." By then I was myself infuriated. I added, "You boast that you have conquered the entire Kshatriya race, but today I will prove that boast false. When you defeated the Kshatriyas, I had not yet been born, nor anyone like me. He who will end your boasts and your desire for battle has now been born. I will destroy your pride. Do not doubt it." The sage smiled. "It is fortunate, O Bhishma, that you wish to fight. I will thus curb your arrogance. We will fight at Kurukshetra. There your mother Ganga will see you thrown down and turned into food for vultures. O ruler of the earth, your mother does not deserve to see such a sight, but it must be so, for you are foolish and overly proud." I bowed before the sage and said, "Be it so." After performing propitiatory rites to invoke the Brahman's blessings, I mounted my chariot and headed out of the city. Equipped with all my weapons, I shielded my chariot with a white umbrella and yoked my white horses, which can move with the speed of the wind. As I moved off, bards and singers eulogized me. I arrived at Kurukshetra and saw Ram waiting there, grasping his huge bow. Thousands of his followers were present, and around the battlefield stood numerous rishis. In the sky I saw the gods headed by Indra. Celestial music sounded, and flowers fell from the heavens. My own mother, assuming her divine human form, came before me and asks, "What do you wish to do, my dear son?" When I told her, she reproved me, "You should not fight with a Brahman. Do not fight Jamadagni's son. His strength is equal to that of Shiva. He exterminated the Kshatriya race. You know all this. Why then have you come to fight with him?" I explained to my mother all that had happened and made it clear that I would not turn back now. She then implored the sage not to fight with me. I was, after all, his disciple, which is none different than his son. The sage said he was determined to teach me a lesson. Helpless to stop either side, my mother retired from the battlefield, feeling anxious for my sake. I looked across at Parasaram and saw that he had no chariot or coat of mail. I called out, "How can I fight you while you stand upon the earth, O Rama? Mount a chariot and put your armor on, for I will now release my weapons." Rama laughed back, "The earth is my chariot, the Vedas are my horses, and the wind is my driver. The mothers of the Vedas, Gayatri, Savitri, and Sarasvati, are my armor. Well protected by all of them, I shall fight, O delighter of the Kurus." The sage immediately covered me on all sides with a thick shower of arrows. Repelling his shafts, I saw him mount a blazing chariot that resembled a city. Celestial horses were yoked to it, and it was protected and ornamented by golden armor and decorations. The chariot was wonderful to behold, and it had been created by his will. Clad in brilliant armor, he stood upon it looking like Yamaraj, surrounded by the personified astras. His disciple, Akritavarna, who had requested him to fight, had become his charioteer, and he dexterously wheeled the chariot about as Rama now called out, "Come, come!" I repelled another two showers of arrows. Then I dismounted my chariot. Putting down my weapons, I went over to the sage and prostrated myself on the ground. "Whether you are my equal in battle or my superior, I will fight with you, my lord, even though you are my preceptor. Bless me that I may attain victory." Rama smiled. "O best of the Kurus, your behavior is proper, and I am pleased by it. If you had not come to me in this way, I would have cursed you. I cannot bless you to gain victory, since I myself want to vanquish you. Go and fight fairly, and with patience, O hero." I returned to my chariot and blew my conch, signaling the start of the battle. Both of us hurled every kind of weapon at each other. Each desiring victory, we fought furiously. Laughing, I released broad-headed shafts which chopped his bow into fragments again and again. Other arrows passed clean through his body and came out dripping blood, entering the earth like hissing serpents. But by his spiritual power, the sage maintained his life and fought back with fearsome energy. Covered with blood, Rama stood in his chariot like a mountain pouring forth lava. He responded with well-sharpened arrows that struck me like thunderbolts. Pierced in my vital organs, I trembled and held on to my flagstaff for support. I summoned all my patience and, regaining my composure, released 100 deadly shafts at Rama. Struck by my arrows, Rama fell senseless to the floor of his chariot. I was immediately seized by remorse. What have I done? I have slain my own preceptor, a virtuous Brahmin. I dropped my weapons and held my head in anguish. But Rama soon rose again, his charioteer having expertly removed the arrows and tended to him. The sun set and we retired for the day, coming together in the evening as friends. The next day at sunrise, we faced each other again on the battlefield. Rama shot blazing arrows with serpent-like mouths. I cut them down with my own arrows, even as they sped through the air. The sage then resorted to celestial weapons, which I countered with my own. During the violent exchange of weapons, I was suddenly caught on the chest by a dart that rendered me unconscious. My charioteer quickly removed me from the battle, and all of Rama's followers, along with Amba, sent up a cheer. After some time, I regained consciousness and ordered my charioteer to take me back to the battle. He urged on my horses, which seemed to dance as they bore us toward Rama. As soon as I saw him, I fired hundreds of straight-flying arrows that screamed through the air, but Rama cut every one of them into pieces with his own arrows, and they fell uselessly to the ground. Then I sent hundreds more shafts at Rama, even as he was countering my last assault. He was caught off guard and knocked unconscious. As he fell from his chariot, a loud cry of, "Alas!" went up from his followers. Seeing him drop to the earth like the sun fallen from the sky, the Kashi princess, along with his many disciples, ran over and comforted him. They sprinkled his face with cool water and uttered benedictory hymns. Rama rose and looked across at me, seated on my chariot. Enraged, he shouted, "Stay, Bhishma, you already killed." Even before remounting his chariot, he shot an arrow which seemed like the rod of death. It hit my right side and sent me spinning. As I reeled, Rama killed my horses. He simultaneously covered me with 1,000 more arrows. Without becoming confounded, I countered his attack with lightness of hand. As I struck down his arrows, my charioteer quickly fetched fresh horses for my chariot. A terrible exchange went on between us. Our celestial arrows met in mid-air and stayed there without falling. The sky became covered with a network of arrows that screened the sun. Rama shot thousands, then tens of thousands, then millions of arrows at me, which I duly countered with divine weapons. A great fire appeared in the sky, reducing the surrounding forest to ashes. As we fought on in this way, the sun set and the battle subsided. We fought for many days, utilizing every celestial weapon and all forms of combat the Vedas describe. Rama released missiles which can hardly be described. They assumed diverse forms and came from every direction. I was continuously whirling in my chariot, repelling his weapons, and trying to counterattack with my own. Both of us sought gaps in our opponent's defenses, and we both defended ourselves closely. The battle raged through the day, and at night we rested. We were both extremely exhausted from the fighting. On the 23rd day of the battle, Rama fought with redoubled strength. All of a sudden, he fired a number of arrows which fell upon my horses and charioteer like venomous serpents. They were all slain, and I was left standing on an immobile chariot as Rama shot arrows charged with death at me. As I fought off his shafts, Rama fired a powerful missile that came at me like a streak of lightning. It caught me on the chest and threw me backwards off the chariot. I fell on the ground, a full 50 paces away. Thinking me dead, Rama roared like a thundercloud, and all of his followers cheered. The Kurus who had accompanied me were overwhelmed with sorrow. As I lay there stupefied, I saw 8 brilliant Brahmins with celestial forms surrounding me. They raised me off the ground and gently supported me. Sprinkling my face with cool water, they said, "Do not be afraid. You will soon be successful." Revived and comforted, I stood up and saw my chariot yoked to fresh horses that my mother was tending. I touched her feet and worshipped the memory of my ancestors. Then I ascended the chariot and sent her away. I took the reins and continued fighting. I managed to catch him with an arrow of great power that pierced him deeply. He dropped to his knees and his bow slipped from his grasp as he fell down senseless. I then saw many inauspicious omens. The sky rained blood and meteors fell. The sun was eclipsed and high winds blew and the earth trembled. But Rama was only stunned. In a short while he got back to his feet and continued the fight. Both of us threw our fiercest weapons at each other until the sun set, when we again retired for the night. That night, as I lay on my bed, my mangled body being tended by physicians, I thought that the battle would never end. I prayed to the gods that they would show me some way to overcome Rama. And then while I was sleeping, I again saw the 8 Brahmins who had visited me on the battlefield. Comforting me again, they said, "Fear not, O son of Ganga. You are our own body, and we will give you all protection. You will surely vanquish Rama. Here is a weapon which was known to you in your previous birth. Manufactured by Vishvakarma, it is called the Prashwapa, and no one on earth knows it, not even Rama. Call it to mine in the battle tomorrow, and it will come to you. Rama will be thrown down by that weapon, but not killed. He cannot be slain, but he will be defeated and rendered unconscious by the Prashwapa. You will then be able to revive him with the Samvodana weapon." The luminous Brahmins vanished, and I awoke with joy. The sun rose, and the battle began again. Encouraged by the celestial Brahmins, I was enlivened and fought with renewed energy. After a furious exchange of weapons, I thought of the Prashwapa. The mantras suddenly appeared in my mind. But as they did, I heard a tumultuous uproar of heavenly voices. "O Bhishma, do not release the Prashwapa missile." Disregarding them, I placed the weapon on my bow and aimed it at Rama. Suddenly, Narad Rishi appeared before me. "The gods are stationed in the sky, and they forbid you to use this weapon. Rama is an ascetic, a Brahmin, and your preceptor. O son of Kuru, do not humiliate him by any means." As Narada spoke, I again saw the 8 Brahmins in the heavens. They smiled and said, "O best of the Bharatas, obey Narada. This will benefit all creatures." Parasaram, seeing the irresistible Prashwapa upon my bow, and not realizing that I had been forbidden to release it, shouted, "Alas, O Bhishma, I am vanquished." And he dropped his bow. His father, Jamadagni, along with other heavenly rishis, then came to him and ordered him to stop fighting. They told him that I was one of the 8 Vasus, and that he could not slay me in battle. Jamadagni said, Arjuna, the powerful son of Indra, will later cause Bhishma's death. Brahma has ordained this. So the battle ended. Severely wounded, I went before my preceptor and prostrated myself at his feet. After this, he said to Amba, O princess, you have seen me exert myself to defeat Bhishma. Still, I have not been able to overpower him. Therefore, you may go where you please. There is nothing more I can do. The maiden replied mournfully, Be it so, O Holy One. You have done your best on my behalf, and I am grateful. Still, my heart burns for revenge. I will practice asceticism. In this way, I will gain the power to personally bring about Bhishma's death. My preceptor was highly pleased with my prowess, and he blessed me that I would be without any equal in battle. After Amba had bowed before him, he left with all his followers. Amba then entered the forest. She went to the Yamuna and performed severe penance. I knew everything because when I returned to Hastinapur, I appointed men to watch over her constantly. They gave me regular reports. For 1 year, she stood on the river bank without eating. Emaciated and rough-skinned, bronzed by the sun, her hair matted, she stood with hands upraised. After 1 year, she broke her fast by eating a single dry leaf. Then she remained waist-deep in the water for another year, standing on 1 foot, fired with indignation. For 12 years she went on in this way. Neither her relatives nor anyone else could convince her to desist. Then she left the Yamuna and wandered at will, visiting the sacred hermitages of many rishis. All the while she continued her austerities, bathing 3 times daily, meditating silently, and fasting. Her appearance changed from gentle to fierce, and she began to glow with ascetic power. One day, as she was bathing in the Ganges, my mother said, Why do you perform such terrible penance, O maiden? Amba replied, I desire to destroy Bhishma, who is so powerful that not even Parasaram could defeat him. Thus I am set upon achieving insuperable powers by my austerities. My ocean-going mother became angry upon hearing her words. O lady, you act crookedly. You will not be able to attain your objective because you are so weak. O daughter of Kashi, if you hold to your determination, I will curse you to become a terrible river, in which water flows in you only during the rainy season. May you be full of crocodiles and other fierce aquatics. After saying this and pretending to smile, my mother vanished, leaving Amba in her waters. Still, the princess did not desist. She performed even more austerities, abstaining from all food and water, and controlling even her breathing. She wandered on, and when she arrived at Vatsabhumi, she fell down and began to run as a river. It is recorded that the river in Vatsabhumi runs only during the rainy season and is unapproachable due to its many crocodiles and dangerous fish. By merit of her austerities, however, only half of her body became a river, while the other half continued as before. She went on with her asceticism, and after some time the rishis at Vatsabhumi approached her. They asked her what she desired, and when she explained, they said, You should seek Mahadev's favor, for that deity can fulfill any desire. Amba supplicated Lord Shiva, and he soon appeared before her, asking to know her desire. When she asked the god for the power to kill me, he replied, You will slay him. Amba then asked how it would be possible, since she was a woman. Lord Shiva replied, My words can never be false. O Blessed One, you will become a man and kill Bhishma in battle. You will remember all this in your next life. Born in Drupada's line, you will become a Maharata, quick in the use of weapons, and highly skilled and fierce in battle. This will come to pass soon. When Lord Shiva vanished, Amba gathered wood and built herself a funeral pyre in the sight of all the rishis. Setting fire to it, her mind burning with wrath, she hurled herself into the pyre, crying, "For the destruction of Bhishma!" So Sikandi was Amba in his last life. He was born first as a woman, and then attained his present form. Listen as I tell you how this occurred. Drupada's queen was childless for a long time. Together she and her husband worshipped Lord Shiva for a child. He prayed for a powerful son, but Shiva told him that his wife would give birth to a daughter, who would later be transformed into a man. Although Drupada beseeched the god for only a son, Lord Shiva replied, "It shall be as I have said, for it has been decreed by destiny." Soon after, Drupada's queen conceived. In due course, she gave birth to a daughter. Remembering Lord Shiva's words, Drupada announced that a son had been born. He had all the rituals performed for a boy. No one saw the baby. Only a few trusted palace staff knew the truth. Drupada raised his child with love, teaching her writing and all the arts. He also had her instructed in bowmanship and other martial skills. When she became a youth, the queen asked Drupada to find her a suitable wife. Drupada was anxious. The child had not been transformed into a son. Were Shiva's words false? But his wife was fixed. Mahadev's promise cannot fail. Sikandi will become a male and therefore should marry a woman. Drupada was convinced by the queen's faith and arranged for a marriage. He chose the daughter of Hiranyavarman, king of the Dasharnakas. That king was unconquerable, and he was happy to give his daughter to Drupada's son. No one suspected anything when the wedding ceremony was performed. The youthful Sikandi, beautiful like a god, appeared dressed as a boy in fine armor. She remembered the events of her previous life and Shiva's words, so even though she had been born a woman, she conducted herself as if she were a man. But it was only a matter of time before Hiranyavarma's daughter discovered the truth. She sent messengers to her father to inform him that Drupada's son was actually a woman. Her father was furious. He sent an emissary to Drupada saying, "I am insulted by your wickedness. How could you have accepted my daughter in marriage for your own daughter? I am preparing now to come and punish you for this act. Soon I will slay you and all your ministers." Drupada was caught like a thief. There was nothing he could say. He tried to convince Sikandi's wife that her husband would in fact soon become a male, but all to no avail. The girl's father amassed a large army and marched on Kampilya. Drupada was alarmed. He said to his wife, "Fools that we are, we have brought a great calamity on our heads. We are in danger. What should we do now, in your opinion?" Drupada and his wife concluded that their only recourse was to worship the gods. Drupada supplicated the deities, while Hiranyavarma advanced on his country. Meanwhile, Sikandi, in sorrow at the danger she felt that she had brought on them all, left the city. Resolved to take her own life, she entered the forest in an area that was home to a powerful yaksha named Stuna. Finding his abode, a white palace washed with lime, she entered it and sat down to practice austerities. A few days later, Stuna returned and saw her sitting there, her body reduced from fasting. Kind by nature, he asked her why she was performing asceticism. The yaksha said, "Tell me if I can do anything to help you." Sikandi replied, "No one can give me what I desire." But Stuna didn't agree. "I can surely give you whatever you wish, O princess. I am Kuvera's attendant and can grant boons. I will bestow even the unbestowable. Tell me what you desire." Sikandi related the whole story in detail, concluding, "The only way to save the present situation is that I attain my manhood, O faultless one." The yaksha, saddened by her story and feeling afflicted by destiny, considered her request carefully. Finally he replied, "Truly this must be so. I will, however, make a condition. I am able to grant your wish only by changing my sex with yours. but you must return my manhood after a short time." Sikandi agreed to return to Stuna as soon as Hiranyavarma left Kampilya. The two then exchanged sexes, and Sikandi went back to her father's palace. When Hiranyavarma's army arrived at Kampilya, he dispatched his priest to Drupada, saying, "Come out and give me battle, vile one. You have cheated me." But by then Sikandi had returned in male form. Drupada said, "There has been a mistake, O Holy One. The king has been misinformed. See for yourself my son's gender." The surprised Hiranyavarma had a number of beautiful maidens sent to examine Sikandi. When they informed him that Drupada's son was indeed male, he entered Kampilya with a glad heart. He stayed with Drupada for some time, and finally returned to his own country, happy in his newfound alliance with Drupada. Stuna had concealed himself in his palace, waiting for Sikandi's return. As he waited, Kuvera happened to pass by, coursing through the skies in his heavenly chariot. He saw Stuna's palace, shining beautifully and adorned with colorful banners, gems, and garlands. Descending, he approached the palace. But when no one came out to greet him, he angrily asked his attendants, "What fool lives here? Why does he not greet me?" Some yakshas then informed Kuvera what had transpired. They told him that Stuna was hiding in shame in his palace. Kuvera replied, "Bring that foolish one here. I will punish him." Stuna came out. In his woman's form, he stood bashfully before his master, Kuvera. "Why have you acted in this way?" Kuvera asked. "You have humiliated the yakshas by giving away your sex. Therefore I curse you not to regain your masculinity. Sikandi, too, will not regain her female form." The other yakshas felt compassion for Stuna. After all, he had acted only out of kindness. They asked Kuvera to set a limit on his curse so that Stuna would not always be punished. Kuvera said, "When Sikandi dies, Stuna will regain his male form. Let him be free of anxiety." The powerful Kuvera, who can travel long distances in a moment, then left with his followers. Shortly afterwards, Sikandi returned. "O Stuna, as we have agreed, I will now return your manhood." Stuna replied, "It has been ordained that manhood shall be yours for this life, O noble one. Be pleased to return to your abode." Hearing this, Sikandi returned in joy to Kampilya. When Bhishma finished telling the story, he added, "Thus Sikandi, formerly Amba, hates me, but because he was first born a woman, I will never raise weapons against him. I have vowed this. I will not fight with weapons against women, or those who bear women's names, or even those who appear like women. O Duryodhan, I will not fight with Sikandi, even if he attacks me, desiring my death." Duryodhan nodded. He looked at Bhishma with respect. Even though the grandfather was often cutting and harsh toward him, the prince could not deny his nobility. Placing his hand on the royal scepter, Duryodhan said, "O son of Ganga, we will now have to fight the mighty Pandava army. Abounding in heroes equal to the universal protectors, this army will be as difficult to cross as the ocean. Tell me, O grandsire, how long you feel it will take you to annihilate them." Bhishma's old leathery face, adorned with a flowing white beard, broke into a smile. "It is fitting that you should ask, Duryodhan. A leader must know both the strength and weaknesses of both the enemy and himself before beginning a fight. Hear, then, of the utmost power I will display in this war. Using ordinary weapons on ordinary soldiers, and celestial weapons on those versed in them, I can slay 10,000 foot soldiers and 1,000 charioteers a day. Or it may be more. If I become fired with anger, when I release my weapons, I can destroy many more men than that. However, you should know that I will only fight fairly." Bhishma reminded Duryodhan of the rules of battle, which he would not break. For example, Heroes should never use divine weapons to kill lesser warriors. The fight should always be equal. Even if one possessed celestial weapons, he should contend only hand to hand with a weaponless enemy, if such became necessary. Bhishma's hand touched his bow. In this way, O king, by fighting ceaselessly throughout the day, I can slay the enemy army in 1 month. Cheering Bhishma, Duryodhan turned toward Drona. O preceptor, what about you? How long do you think it will take you to overcome the enemy? Like Bhishma, Drona smiled at Duryodhan. I am old and have lost some of my strength. Still, I will exert myself fully and consume the Pandava army by the fire of my weapons. I also think I can annihilate all the warriors in about a month. Kripa said it would take him 2 months, and Ashvatthama, bolder, said he could do it in 10 days. Karna said he could annihilate the enemy in 5 days, at which Bhishma laughed and said, You may speak in such strains only so long as you do not encounter Arjuna with his weapons and his conch, guided by Vasudev. Say whatever you will, O son of Radha, for talk is cheap. Karna frowned but remained silent. Duryodhan continued questioning his generals and commanders, ascertaining their power and determination to fight. The Kauravas discussed their battle plans well into the night. Soon after sunrise, the fight would begin.